Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Lynn Young.
Today, we'll look at how advanced technology is bringing fantasy to life in the movies.
It sort of unlocked the door to allow people to be able to do this kind of performance capture and use actors to create great performances really anywhere that they care to do that.
Scientists have developed a new wheelchair that can be steered only with eye movement.
And so we observe eye movements with an eye tracker, and we then try to make sense of them, and computer interprets these commands and then drives the wheelchair accordingly.
It's nearly the centennial of World War I. We'll ride along in some vintage aircraft.
Some American colleges are using solar power to light up their campuses.
Fabien Cousteau breaks his famous grandfather's record. And Doug Bernard will be along to talk the Supreme Court and your cell phone. That's coming up on Now. If you heard Monday's show, you heard our preview of The Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which opens this week.
One technology that played a big role in the movie is advanced motion capture filmmaking.
As Elizabeth Lee tells us, the new tech has given actors and directors the chance to do what they've never done before.
It is a story about survival and whether two species can coexist. Visual effects allow humans to play the apes through performance capture technology. Andy Serkis played the lead role of the ape, Caesar.
As an actor, you're used to working with a wide variety of situations where the imagination is driving it.
The ape actors wore head-mounted cameras and dots on their bodies and faces to capture their motion and expressions. Traditionally shot on an interior set, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes took the performance outdoors, pushing the boundaries of what's been done before, says visual effects supervisor Dan Lemon.
It sort of unlocked the door to allow people to be able to do this kind of performance capture and use actors to create great performances really anywhere that they care to do that.
Most of the film was shot in the forests of Vancouver in Canada and near New Orleans with 3D and motion capture cameras. Visual effects supervisor Joe Terry says shooting in a damp or wet environment full of vegetation meant developing some new technology.
We had to build all new cameras that allowed us to do that. We built wireless camera systems to help with the integration and the deployment. We built new controllers for the actors to wear that drove all the sensors that fed the information to the camera.
Director Matt Reeves says while working with visual effects in this way can make his work more complex, it is also liberating.
This was like going in and continuing to refine in a way that you can't do with traditional movie making. That part was amazing.
Okay, and 3, 2, 1, action.
In addition to the technological challenges of making this movie, many of the actors had to train to think and move like apes.
It's about undoing what makes us human and just boiling down to the animal that we are. That's really what it is. And that's the toughest part to get over.
Terry Notary played an ape and was the ape movement coach and stunt coordinator on the movie.
Go. Left, right, left, right.
Reporters got a feel of the challenges of moving like an ape with arm extensions worn by the actors to give them longer arms and shorter legs. It took 6 weeks for the actors to train with Notary and become ape-like. Beyond the physical and technical demands of this movie, the process of transforming oneself into a character is the same, says actor Andy Serkis, with the goal of trying to be as believable as possible.
They want what we want, to survive.
Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, San Francisco.
To your home. Your home.
Are you aware they are going to turn on you?
Did you see the rise of the Planet of the Apes?
No, not yet, but yeah. I plan to. Did you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, and the same guy, Andy Serkis, the guy who played Gollum. You saw The Lord of the Rings?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the same guy that played Gollum, you know,
my precious.
That dude is Caesar in this movie.
Okay.
But it's like he's wearing all this stuff, you know, like there are little sensors all over his body. Mm-hmm. So basically the computer is capturing his body, and then they animate the ape. Figure
they,
over
yes,
the top of
exactly.
The human actor's motion.
It's just they can do so many things that they can't even imagine before because you can't follow an ape and then just film it.
No. Well, the real one wouldn't behave the way you want him to.
Exactly.
See, this is Hollywood. You can't say,
come here.
Ape, please.
Yeah, please. No, you're supposed to look to the left. No. But it's really fascinating, and you know, it's coming to the point where it's just so seamless, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's just fascinating.
It is fascinating. Well, to see Elizabeth's story on video, you can log on to our webpage, www.voanews.com.
And post your comments to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow. While Hollywood is using advanced tech to make fantasy come alive, some scientists in England are using it to help the disabled.
Researchers at Imperial College London have developed an inexpensive, easy-to-use system that could help wheelchair-bound people.
As Laditza Hoke tells us, the system uses only a person's eyes to drive their wheelchair.
Most people suffering from multiple sclerosis or spinal cord injuries can still move their eyes because they are directly connected to the brain. Some existing technologies already allow severely disabled people to stare at arrows on a computer and direct the movement of a wheelchair. But there are problems with that system, including a delay between the movement of the eyes and the wheelchair.
Current tracking software often uses screen-based systems where you have a screen open and you look at locations on the screen. Problem with that is that it's very simplistic and also it diverts the user's attention from the outside world, and therefore there's more risk of not noticing obstacles or other things in the way.
A team led by Dr. Aldo Faisal at Imperial College London has developed software that allows users to maneuver the chair just by looking in the direction they want to take.
Our eyes are not only a window into our soul, they're also a window now to our intentions. So if we want to go somewhere, for example, if I want to go there or there, I will look there, and I will look there in a specific manner. And we can build a computer system that can decode our eye movements. And so we observe eye movements with an eye tracker, and we then try to make sense of them. And computer interprets these commands and then drives the wheelchair accordingly.
Two cameras trained on the eyes observe their movements and can determine whether a patient is merely looking around or wants to move in a certain direction.
So essentially we track the pupil of the eye, and via a calibration process we relate that to where the subject's looking in the world around them.
Visual information detected by cameras is analyzed by algorithms within 10 milliseconds and translated into instructions for movement that's almost instantaneous.
At the moment I'm just looking forward at, towards the floor, but exactly at points on the floor that I would like to go to, and the wheelchair is just responding. So if I look rightward slightly towards Will, I'll move over, or I can go look left as well. And it just responds to my gaze or my desired location that I would like to go to.
The camera-based system costs only about $85 because most of the work is done by the algorithms. No expensive hardware is needed. The London team hopes to make the system commercially available within 3 years. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
To see the eye-controlled wheelchair in action, be sure to log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And don't forget to let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter. We're at NowVOAShow. Later this month, the world will mark 100 years since the start of World War I.
The war left nearly 10 million soldiers dead and millions of others wounded.
It was also the first war in history in which aircraft played a major role.
As VOA's George Puttich tells us, there's a place in France that works to preserve some of the airplanes from the Great Wall.
Since 1929, the Salis aircraft collection at the La Ferté-Ali airfield, about 40 kilometers south of Paris, has been a place where old planes, like this Boeing Stearman PT-17, are restored to flying condition. It was built in 1940s for training U.S. military pilots. Out of more than 10,000 produced, only about 20 remain, flying mostly at air shows. But the most prized possession of the collection is the Blériot 11, in which Louis Blériot became the first pilot to fly across the English Channel in 1909. Baptiste Salis, grandson of the man who started the collection, says flying it makes you feel the weight of the history.
It is rather extraordinary to fly a machine that is 100 years old. Sometimes these machines have really high performance, on the contrary of what one might think. And you can feel these emotions coming from the history of these planes and the pilots that were flying them.
Aircraft mechanic Xavier Gache says one of the greatest challenges is finding parts and material for restoration.
If you want to make an identical old plane with original pieces, it will be complicated. You would need to invest in much more expensive canvases. You can still find them, but they will cost, let's say, four times more. Screws are not easy to find, engines even more difficult. Very often you have to make pieces yourself. It costs lots of money.
To make money for restoration, the workshop builds replicas of vintage aircraft for use in films and commercials, like this British World War I fighter plane, SE-5.
For example, here behind me, you have a star that was in the film Ace of Aces with Jean-Paul Belmondo. It is a replica of an SE-5. It has its shape, but it is not the real one.
The collection features several warplanes, including the World War I French fighter Spad 13 and World War II B-17 Flying Fortress. Pilot Gaël D'Amico, who owns a Belgian trainer, Stamp SV4, says flying vintage planes gives you a special feeling.
I feel like being 50 years back in time and the sensation of having your head outside. That is superb.
Every May, the Salis Collection organizes an air show, and visitors can see many of the planes as they were meant to be seen, in flight. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
To see video of some of these planes in flight where they belong, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And post your comments on our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Tomorrow, way too far away, and we can't get back yesterday. But we young right now, we got right now, so get up right now, 'cause all we got is right now.
Here in Washington, a couple of major universities plan to buy solar power to light up their campuses.
The schools expect the project will save millions of dollars during the next couple of decades.
As Jim Randall tells us, the plan will also make the schools more attractive to environmentally conscious students.
Solar panels cover the roof of this and other buildings at American University, creating electricity that is a fraction of the power needed by the campus. AU, George Washington University, and George Washington University Hospital are going a big step further in a deal with Duke Energy Renewables, a division of a large power company. Duke will build three new solar power farms similar to these facilities in distant North Carolina and put the power into the electric grid. The schools in Washington will draw electricity from the grid and pay Duke for the power at a fixed rate for the next 20 years. Chief Financial Officer of American University, Doug Kadravitz, says the green solar power deal will look better and better over time.
Over the next 20 years, brown power can only go one direction, and we anticipate saving quite a bit of money over that period of time.
American University's Director of Sustainability, Chris O'Brien, says using renewable energy instead of brown power, traditional oil, coal, or gas-fueled electricity, will reduce the environmental impact of campus activities.
It's the right thing for social equity because some of the worst impacts of climate change are borne by the poor. So to the degree that we can convert to renewable sources, that actually lessens the impact, the burden on people who live in poverty.
There are a growing number of solar facilities around the world. Duke Energy Renewables' new units will have nearly a quarter of a million solar panels and generate 123 million kilowatt hours of electricity per year. The switch away from fossil fuels will have the same environmental benefit as getting 12,500 cars off the road. The head of the Solar Energy Industries Association is Roan Resch.
This is an innovative new type of business model for solar. But what it shows is that you can go solar no matter if you have roof space or if you're entering into a contract with a developer. I think this is the future of solar energy, and we're seeing it today.
Resch says solar is growing fast, but admits it provides just a small fraction of the electricity needed to run the world's biggest economy. He says falling prices for equipment and innovations in financing are now doing as much as technical developments to help spread solar energy. In the meantime, students at American University take advantage of a solar water heater on the roof of a campus building that preheats water for coffee and saves energy in a shop several floors below. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
That sounds like a great idea, if you can light up the whole campuses with just solar power. And
you know,
we have so much sun here in Washington.
This seems to be a recurring theme with you and me.
Exactly.
You know, we've been talking
about cars.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. This is, you know, these universities are getting these solar arrays, and basically they're buying the power from Duke Energy, and Duke Energy has the solar arrays.
Yeah.
But if, you know, you're not going to put out the sun, so if the sun can be turned into power, then the money you would have spent on power, you can spend on all kinds of other things, like research and student services and library books and teacher salaries and all those other fun things. Well, I mean, you know, because it will also make it, as the report said, more attractive to people who are like, well, I want to pay my tuition to somewhere that cares about the environment.
Exactly. And a lot of people are becoming more environmentally conscious these days.
Yeah. You know, Lynn almost has me to the point where I'm going to the local store to buy one of those big things for the roof.
To see a video of this story, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And be sure to post your comments on our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
Lynn, did you ever watch the old Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau specials used to come on television?
I don't recall that.
They were probably on before you were born.
Okay.
They were in the 1970s.
That explains.
Well, see, now the thing is, you know, the explorer, the oceanographer, Jacques Cousteau, you know, he used to have these things where he'd film all his dives, and he went to all these exotic locations and discovered all these lagoons and reefs.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, and,
it's
you know,
the whole world under the ocean, right?
Well, I mean, he was instrumental in the invention of what we call SCUBA, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus.
Okay.
And, you know, once you got that, then you can go under the water and stay for a long time.
Exactly.
And he's doing all this kind of research,
diving,
you know.
Diving sounds amazing.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Yeah. I did my first tank dive this past January.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's fun.
How was that?
I had problems with buoyancy because, you know, when you breathe in, you go up, and when you breathe out, you go down.
Okay.
And you kind of have to adjust how you breathe so you can stay level. Yeah, I had a little trouble with that. But, you know, his grandson, Fabien Cousteau, has now broken one of his grandfather's long-standing records.
In a specially designed submerged habitat called Aquarius, Fabien Cousteau spent 31 days under the ocean off the Florida Keys.
Aquarius was equipped with wireless internet access, a shower, a bathroom, and six bunks. It also had large portholes that allowed Cousteau and other researchers to view marine life around the clock.
After surfacing last week, Fabien said his goal was never to break his grandfather's record, but to help people understand the oceans.
The record was never really the focal point. I knew it was a hook. I knew that symbolic one extra day would get people's attention, curiosity at very least. I think what he'd probably be most proud of is that we were able to reach so many people. The goal symbolically was to reach at least 331 million around the world. We've hit all six continents, and we're waiting for the metrics, but I believe we're way beyond that.
Fabien Cousteau said the mission accomplished its goal of raising awareness about the Earth's oceans.
It has been an extraordinarily difficult endeavor, and it was not without its challenges. But at the end of the day, I feel it's been extraordinarily successful.
The project was a joint venture with Florida International University and also featured researchers from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Northeastern University in Boston. It's the end of the Supreme Court's term just this past week, and there were several decisions handed down that could have long-ranging effects. One of them involved whether police officers and other law enforcement need a warrant before they can search your cell phone. Joining me now is Doug Bernard. Doug is our internet and tech correspondent. Doug, welcome, first of all.
It's great to be here.
Now, this decision governed whether police can actually search the contents of your mobile device if they pull you over or they arrest you. Right?
That's right. That's right. So, for example, police, if you're pulled over on suspicion of having committed a crime, they could search your car, they could search your clothes. If you're carrying a pack of cigarettes, as the court referenced, they could open that up. And occasionally, they do find incriminating evidence in there. What happened in this one particular case that made its way to the Supreme Court is a man named David Riley was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder. The police seized his cell phone and began searching through it and found all kinds of incriminating pictures and texts and that sort of thing. That evidence came to trial and ended up landing him in jail. Well, he's still in jail, by the way. So this ruling didn't really give him very much right now. But as the case went to the court and to the Supreme Court, what the nine justices unanimously found is that the warrantless search of a mobile phone is tantamount to police breaking into your home, your castle, and just searching around for whatever they want on a fishing expedition.
Now, let's give our audience a little constitutional law primer in case they don't know. The Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution says basically, now this is a layman's translation. Right. The lawyers in the crowd can just, you know, send me email.
Sue you.
Basically, they do not allow for the unlawful search and seizure of your property without a warrant, which
Precisely.
Gives probable cause. In other words, they have to say, we believe that you have the gun with which Mr. Thompson was shot in your apartment, and we want to come look for it.
Exactly.
And they have to present that to you when they do the search.
Right. A judge has to agree.
A judge
to
has
it.
To agree that there's a preponderance of evidence that, yes, there is probable cause that Mr. So-and-so might have this pistol.
Exactly.
And then they can come in and look for it. But in the case of a mobile phone, they didn't have a warrant
That's
to
right.
go looking. And so any evidence that they find as a result of that search is considered inadmissible in court.
That's right, and it's even broader than that because, for example, if the police come in to search for a gun, they can look around for that gun, but they can't start looking around for other things as well that, we didn't really know we were going to find this, but look what we found over here.
Right.
So what happens, what the justices said, is that mobile phones in this world are unique in the amount of intensely personal information that they carry.
Right.
So you can really create, you know, such a comprehensive portrait of an individual that just going and, you know, searching through a phone, the justices unanimously said, look, this is warrantless, not only warrantless, but unreasonable search and seizure.
And how much of our data are people really going to be able to get access to?
But what this case and this ruling may suggest is that the justices, in effect, get it. They understand that these clouds of data that we have around us that say so much about us are so very vulnerable to unreasonable search. So think about cases, for example, like cell phone tracking. And these cases are working their way up through the legal system. Prosecutors or police will get cell phone records. These aren't calls that you're making. It's just where you are in at any particular point in any particular time.
Based upon the GPS that's attached to your phone.
And where the cell phone towers are saying, well, you know, we triangulate and he's here, he's there, he's there. Think about the implications in terms of NSA lawsuits, and those are also working their way up through the system. These are cases where people are saying, look, you know, the NSA is hoovering up, vacuuming up enormous amounts of data about me, my activities, what I'm saying, what I'm doing. Is that not perhaps a unreasonable search and seizure? So I think potentially it may be a game changer when it comes to electronic privacy.
All right, that's VOA's Doug Bernard. For more on this, you can log on to our website, www.voanews.com. And Doug, thank you very much.
It's always great to be here.
Thanks for joining us for this Tuesday edition of Now.
If you want to see video of the stories on our show, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And if you'd like to hear our show again, visit voanews.com/now, or we're also on iTunes.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao.
Until tomorrow, I'm Lin Yang.
And I'm David Byrd. Join us again Wednesday for another edition of Now.